Tuesday, November 20th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Now, I'm sure that you've heard that Donald Trump is filling out his cabinet with many, many luminaries, as he defines them, other executive positions being filled up as well. Recently tabbed Linda McMahon, who did serve in his first cabinet, more importantly, as Reuters reports.
McMahon is the co-founder and former CEO of the WWE professional wrestling franchise. She was a major donor to Trump during his first presidential bid and headed up the Small Business Administration in the billionaire's first term. Trump also said Tuesday that he had chosen television personality and surgeon Dr. Mehmet Oz to serve as administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Wrestling impresarios, TV doctors, bear carcass disseminators. You know that Donald Trump has a type. He is a creature of the New York tabloids of the 80s and 90s, and he watches a lot of TV. So we at The Gist, along with a predictive algorithm that we plug some of his previous choices into, have come up with a definitive list of Donald Trump and his new cabinet and executive level appointments. Here are some of them. Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security Affairs, that'll go to Heidi Fleiss. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Joe Namath. EPA Assistant Administrator for Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, Sally Jesse Raphael. Undersecretary for Growth, Energy, and the Environment, it's ALF. Assistant Secretary for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, Coco the Gorilla. Assistant Secretary for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs, Leona Helmsley. She'll ride herd over that department. Assistant Secretary for Readiness, TV funny man, Fred Travellina. Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for Administration, the Cabbage Patch Kids. Assistant Secretary for Cyber Policy. This will be Irina and Louise Mandrell, but not Barbara. Surprising choice there. Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment,
Charles Nelson Reilly, Phyllis Diller.
Oh man, I thought he'd go with Charles Nelson Reilly for the block, or at least for Assistant Secretary for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs. But no, that's
Peace, Buck McKenzie, what party-loving happening dude?
Assistant Secretary for Energy, Installations, and the Environment, Prom Mom. Assistant Secretary for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs, the Duggars. There's a lot of them. Assistant Secretary for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict, Baby Jessica. Now she's out of the well. Assistant Secretary for Sustainment, Honey Boo Boo.
Pumpkin may not be the sharpest tool in the shed, but she sure can plan a snack escape.
Assistant Secretary for Air Force Acquisition Technology and Logistics. Well, that'll go to, it's not quite said, it's whoever will win the Star Search Team Dance Competition. All right. Assistant Secretary for the Air Force for Financial Management and Controller, the Unabomber. In the VA, the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection, Dennis Rodman.
And Obama didn't even give me the time of day. I asked him. I said, I have something to say from North Korea. He just brushed me off.
Department of Veterans Affairs once more, Assistant Secretary for Enforcement and Compliance, Oksana Bayul. So good in those Winter Olympics so many years ago. Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Installations, Environment, and Energy, High Pitch Eric. Assistant Secretary for the Air Force for Space Acquisition and Integration, Joan Embry of the San Diego Zoo. Assistant Secretary for the Army for Acquisitions, Logistics, and Technology. They're not sure he's going to be able to get this through, but the idea is it will go to the third caller on the contest line, provided he knows the phrase that pays. Department of Transportation Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for Budget and Programs, Sharon Osbourne. Stalking horse for Ozzy, I think. NASA's Director of Research and Procurement, Lisa Nowak. Wait, who is Lisa Nowak? Oh, she was the astronaut who drove 15 hours wearing the maximum absorbency garment diaper to attack a romantic rival. Wait a minute, that kind of makes sense and actually might work. Okay, forget it. She's going to be replaced by a young Tony Danza. How do we get him young? Doesn't matter.
A guy can do what he can do, and he can't do what he can't do. So if a guy doesn't do what he can't do, what are you going to do?
Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works, Robert the Preppy Killer Chambers. Office of Management and Budget, Sarah Purcell and Skip Stevenson. Department of Commerce's Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for Administration, Joey Buttafuoco. And there we have, thank you to our advanced AI, much of the Trump cabinet and executive position staffing. You know, that was kind of serious. I want to actually lighten things up. And on the show, I give you a delightful full show interview with Jim O'Hare. He's Jerry, or perhaps Gary, from Parks and Rec. Parks and Rec, the Pawnee department thereof, an actual government agency staffed with dedicated experts, except for maybe Jerry, perhaps his name was Larry, a running gag on Parks and Rec. But you don't have to know all the gags to be delighted by my conversation with Jim O'Hare, who is out with a new book, Welcome to Pawnee, Stories of Friendship, Waffles, and Parks and Recreation.
Jerry, I need to see your softball pictures.
Here you go, Chief.
Wow, good job. Nice
Ew,
work.
Wait a minute. Isn't that that creepy guy? Morgan, the pedophile?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Come on. I didn't know that.
He seemed okay. We had dinner together.
Guys, I don't know if I made it clear, but I don't want any sex offenders in our parks catalog.
Okay, I will Photoshop his face.
Can you Photoshop your life with better decisions, Jerry?
Okay.
Jim O'Hare is an actor you know, or maybe it's Tim O'Hare or Flynn O'Hare. I don't know. He played Jerry in Parks and Rec, or actually it turned out it was Gary, or maybe Larry or Terry. He's out with a new book called Welcome to Pawnee. It answers all the questions I didn't know I had, and I'm going to ask Jim some more. Hey, welcome to The Gist.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
So I know that you were up for the role of Ron Swanson, and you are the first to say, thankfully, it didn't go to you because of it went to Nick Offerman, and he's fantastic. Were they seeing you, where they're asking you to read because they were really considering you for that role? Or do they do the thing where they want to get a bunch of people in to give them ideas for other roles in this really big cast?
That's exactly what they were doing. When it's such a big, high-profile show, because this one in is, you know, when I was first heard of it, it was the untitled Amy Poehler project. And it had already been given an episode order. Normally, you do a pilot, it's one and done, and then it either gets picked up or it doesn't. Generally, they don't. But this had a lot of juice behind it before it ever went in front of a camera. So my guess is the network was like, yeah, you got to give us a lot of choices. I think Mike and Greg, you know, Mike Shirk, Greg Daniels, Nick was always their guy, most likely. But I also, in doing this book, I learned so many things. And Mike said to me, there was somebody else. It was almost somebody else. But Nick ultimately was their choice. And so to bring in people like me, I'm just, you know, someone who'd been out there a lot, very much a journeyman actor. And the casting director had said, which again, I find this all out later. I didn't know any of this until I was putting this book together. The casting director said, her name was Allison Jones. And she's like, you got to see Jim O'Hare. He's a funny guy.
Yeah.
So they did. And so I went in and my going in on that type of audition is always, I want to impress them. Never thinking they're giving me one of the co-leads in the new Amy Poehler project.
Right. Right, which, as you say, is hot. Daniels and Schur had just done The Office, so they were
the
Golden
Office
Boys.
Yes.
And Amy Poehler was this breakout star on SNL who was under contract with the network, and that's why it wasn't just a pilot. This was a done deal. So you were like, huh, an unknown is the second star. Me,
exactly.
But still.
Yes. Yeah, even though I had that fate, you know, so many times, but, oh, you look so familiar out in the world. Right. I'd worked a lot, but again, unknown, technically. And so they... So my goal was just to impress them enough that maybe down the road they'll give me a guest spot or they'll give me maybe on The Office, you know, because I'm a big fan of The Office and I knew who these guys were. So I just wanted to do a good job in the room. And apparently I did whatever my interpretation of Ron Swanson was good enough to have them bring me back for the role of Jerry down the line, which even when they did that, they obviously didn't know what they were looking for, because when I walk into an audition room, generally, I'm going to see me. And by that, I mean, I'm going to see the other big guy, the other tall, fat, whatever terms you want to use. Yeah. I'm going to see that guy.
These are Midwesterners who like college football and, let's say, eat Cinnabons. Yeah.
Exactly. 100%. Yeah. Ooh, yummy. But I walked into that room, to that audition room, and it was not me. I mean, there were some me's, but there was tall and short and fat and skinny and black and white and Asian. And it was across the board. So they
Is that intimidating or is that a compliment?
Yeah, it's weird. It can be a blessing and a curse. Like, if ultimately they truly did want my type, there were just a couple of options. So that helps me.
Right.
But if they truly don't know what they want, There's a lot of people, a lot of other options out there. And so that can be a little scary. But, I, you know, for whatever miracle, it did go my way. And I, it's so weird because, you know, when actors, we audition all the time and it's the grind. And the thing about this business is I found out a statistic. They say that if an actor books 1 out of 10 auditions, they're doing well, which means 90% of our lives, we're being told no. No, you're not it. You're not the guy or girl, or whatever. And right. So,
or things like, or they loved you, but you were too funny.
A million times. Oh, they loved you. I tell the story in the book. I did an audition where I thought I nailed it. And this is pre-Parks. And my phone was ringing like 10 minutes after I got in the car. And I'm thinking, damn, that was a quick booking. And my agent is calling to tell me I lost the job because it was a dramatic role. And they thought they couldn't see past the humor I brought into the room when we were just chatting, which, of course, makes me effing crazy because we're actors. See past whatever my bullshit is up front and take a look at the audition. But anyway, it was a lesson learned.
Right. And you also would think that casting directors know that actors aren't just one thing and people aren't just one thing. And you shouldn't have to make them work to see the serious thing. But if you're being funny and they're vibing with that charismatically, you would hope they would say, okay, there's a way to use this. This guy pops on screen. This guy will be fun to work with. It would seem to be more of a benefit than a detriment. But you say that you changed the way you audition for every dramatic role since.
I walk in. I'm very hello. I do my basic pleasantries, and then I do the audition. And I've even had to be careful now because of Parks, a lot of times, you know, the people in the room, they want to ask me questions about Parks because, you know, for whatever miracle has happened, it is a show that has broken through just normal shows that are shot, done, and then disappear. We're still out there. We're syndicated. We're on TV stations. We're streaming. We're still out there. And it's a beloved show, which I'm so grateful, like every day grateful for. So people will say, hey, what was this like? What was that like? What was Chris Pratt like? How was Amy Poehler? And I feel bad, but I kind of have to shut it down if it's a dramatic audition. Now, if I'm in there for some comedy thing, I'll tell my stories. Mm-hmm. I got stories and I'm happy to tell them. But yeah, I had to learn a lesson. But when I went in for Parks, I think what I found out later was, you know, when I was interviewing Greg's like, yeah, we just liked you. You were funny. And we're like, put him at a desk. It'll work out. Yeah. You know, of course, I never knew that.
And so they probably, you couldn't have read for Jerry, right? Because Jerry at that point probably didn't have any lines. Just an
idea. He didn't exist.
Yeah. Let's put some talented people in the background with the expectation that they'll have more of a role. And that was the template of The Office. And with Parks and Rec, there were even fewer people in that literal office. So your role was even bigger than any of the background players or office workers on The Office.
Well, dude, I'll tell you, my agents called when the offer came in to do the show. You know, the official, once I had, you know, I'd read for Ron, a couple weeks later, I read for Jerry. And then, I don't know, 2 weeks later, I get the call to, you know, to do the role of Jerry. And my agents, and I'm not slighting them for this, they were totally looking out for me. But they said, we don't know if you should do this. And I said, what are you talking about? I was so excited. Like, this sounds great. And they said, they're being honest with us. They don't know what's happening with this character. And so believe me, there's nothing wrong with background work. But at this point in my career, I'd been a busy actor. I wasn't doing background work. And they said, you might feel like.
And I should just say, background work is the nice term for extra.
Extra work. Yes. Yeah. And it's great.
You wouldn't want to be hired to be an extra. Yeah.
Well, not at that point in my career, certainly. Yeah. You know. Yeah. So I said, oh, no, this is a no-brainer. I have watched every episode of The Office. I have seen what has happened to those background workers, the Kevins and the Phyllis and the Oscars and the Stanleys and the Merediths. So for me, it was a no-brainer. And just like on The Office, these background players became, you know, part of the history of the show.
But Parks and Rec was a very improv-friendly show. And some of the great lines were Chris Pratt, who's too handsome to be that funny, saying things like, you know, in an episode where Leslie thinks she has the flu, he says,
Leslie, I typed your symptoms into the thing up here, and it says you could have network connectivity problems.
And apparently that was just off his dome. That was
off his dome. And Mike Schur will tell you That is the funniest line ever not written on Parks and Recreation. And it's true. You know,
it works on many levels, right?
It works on so many levels.
That's his character would say it. And yeah, yeah. It's great. Yeah.
There's also an infamous, if you go on YouTube, outtake of Pratt regarding the Kardashians. I don't know if you've ever seen it. If you haven't, go to YouTube. It's crazy.
Everyone loves a good comeback story, right? Seabiscuit, the Mighty Ducks,
Robert Downey Jr., who
Rocky
else? Yes.
Kim Kardashian.
Kim, well.
Well, in the video, she gets come on her back, I think.
But here's what they would do. And I think it's why the cast remained as tight as we have remained and why we were so tight during the show. After every scene was done, everyone's happy, director, writers, actor, everyone's happy with the scene, they would yell, okay, fun run. And fun run meant we could do whatever the hell we wanted. And I mean, we knew what the scene was, we knew what we had to get to, but we could say whatever the hell we wanted to. And that's when some of this crazy stuff would come up. And the genius, again, in my opinion, of them having us do this, when improvisers are doing that, they're playing together. They're having fun. And I think that just tightened up this squad. And to this day, we have a thing called the Parks Family Text. We are still super tight with each other. Everybody for this book jumped in. Pratt, who's so damn busy, I don't think he knows what country he's in half the time. He sat down and made time for it. It's a special group of people. But yes, the other thing
I have to tell my audience, the book reads as it's very much Jim's story, but it's also a quasi oral history of Parks and Rec. It works on that level. You have interviews, or you'll be talking about something that you only know from your perspective, and then boom, Greg Daniels jumps in, or Chris Pratt jumps in, and they'll tell you what they know from their perspective.
And what I've also learned, I think this is something we all know, but until you do it, it's so amazing how we can think one thing and someone else was thinking something totally else during the same situation.
Right.
That's why stories a lot of times don't match up in the real world. Like someone said this and someone said, I didn't say that, I said this. So it was so great to get their perspectives. But the thing I have to give credit to, Mike Shore created, and Greg, a writer's room of, it's a big word, but I'm going to say it, writing geniuses. And the scripts were so tight that even though we get a lot of credit for the improvisation that happened on that show, those scripts were so tight, they didn't need us. They did not need us. Every week, I would leave a table read, and I'd go, I can't believe they've done it again. Because, again, as someone who's so enamored with writers, I was just blown away.
Yeah.
And so it was, we get a lot of credit for being these improv geniuses, but 99% of the credit has to go to the writers. It just really does.
You probably know this, but I think creativity flourishes within limits, right? And so when they do a fun take, you still know the beat you have to hit, the parameters.
Absolutely.
You know what the furniture is, and then you figure out how to sit on it or where to walk around it, metaphor.
And some of the fun runs would go for 20 minutes, which is silly. It's a 21-minute show. You cannot have one scene doing 20 minutes. And here's this
you impose a bottle episode upon the show where it was not there. It just
exactly.
<too good.
laughs> And one of my favorite stories I had heard was Mike and Amy had very much, you know, because Greg, he was with us, but I had to go back to the office. He was their showrunner, and Mike Shore was our showrunner.
Like a dad.
But
like a dad.
Like a dad. They're there.
The
they keep track of everything. It's a big, big, big job. But Amy was very much, we all called her, you know, our fearless leader. She was the mom. I'm easily 8 years older than Amy, maybe 9. And she was my mother as much as everyone else's mother on that set. That's just, you know, who Amy is. Mike and Amy had a no assholes policy.
Yeah.
So if somebody came in and they weren't ready to play, they were never seen again. And one of my favorite stories is we had a new director come in, and every time we had a new director, they would check in with us afterward. How did it go? Did you have any issues? Blah, blah, blah. And not, you know, most of the time we never had. I remember there was one director, they were a little gruff, I thought, compared to how we normally ran things. And
was that Werner Herzog?
No, you know, it was not Werner. Oh, God, but he did the show. How awesome is that? It was not Warner, but it was somebody, and then we never saw them again. So how it went. But one of the directors had said to our line producer was Morgan Sackett, who is the greatest line producer, who's now an exec producer. He's doing Hacks and everything else. He's amazing. He's so great at his job. But they said to him, because Morgan checked in with him, how's it going? And the director said, well, it's good, but sometimes it's hard to get them to break apart. They're all chatting and laughing. And Morgan said, if our worst problem is that these people are getting along, we'll eat that time, whatever that, you know what I mean? If that's going to cause us a little extra time, we will eat it. Because let me tell you, I've been on a lot of shows. I did an interview recently where they told me, and I looked it up afterward because, to be honest, I hadn't known, but I have over 200 credits on IMDb.
Most of them as a Santa Claus of some sort.
A lot of Santa Claus.
A lot of Santas.
I did one last year with Octavia Spencer. That was amazing. So I have a lot of, over 200 credits. I've been on a lot of shows. I've been on Friends. I've been on so many different shows over the years.
Right.
And it makes me crazy when I'm watching a late night show and somebody from a show is guesting and they're like, oh, we're like one big happy family. And I'm like, F you. I was on your show. Nobody was talking to anybody. You were miserable. Right. And the difference with Parks is it was this amazing experience. I used to hate the days I was off, which how crazy is that? Like, we'd get these day of days for the next week telling you what your schedule is going to be. And like, so say it would be like I'm working, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, off Thursday, work Friday. I'd be like, oh, damn, Thursdays are good. You know, like I wanted to be there. And it wasn't just this amazing cast who I love, but the crew, we had 85% of the crew stayed with us for the entire show. Mike, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. When we wrapped, when they decided to do a 13 final episodes of the last season, and the network let Mike and Amy decide, how do they want to do this? Do they want to keep going? Do they want to wrap it up? And Amy had always said, I want to go out with people wanting more. We don't want to go out where we're like, oh God, is that thing still on the air? And so her and Mike made the decision to do 13. Now, I just assumed that we're going to lose a lot of our crew because they're going to try to get on shows that are going, you know, the full 22, 24 episodes. We lost one person.
Yeah.
One person. And you couldn't blame them. I totally get why somebody would leave if there was a possibility. But these other people were like, no, I got to see it end. I got to be here for it. So it was that kind of a place.
So all of the actors, the crew, they loved going to work. Which characters in Parks and Rec do you think didn't like going to work at the Pawnee office of Parks and Rec? Because I know Ron Swanson, as a libertarian, probably doesn't think his job should exist. But of course, he's curmudgeonly and very much bonded and needed those people. Who else in the office do you think didn't want to go to work every day?
Well, you know, I think Tom, Aziz's character, he wanted to be elsewhere. He's a baller, as he will tell you.
Yeah, he wanted to be developing his toddler cologne, right?
Exactly. So he wants to be somewhere else. Jerry, my character, he absolutely is fine there. It's a job. He doesn't care. It's all about getting home to his family at the end of the day. So for Jerry, 100%, he wants to be
there. You can understand why upon meeting his family.
Of course. Of course. The beautiful Christie Brinkley.
When they told you she was being cast as your wife, what was your reaction?
Well, dude, I wasn't. Here's what I was told. We're going to look for a Christie Brinkley type.
Uh-huh.
So my reaction just from that was, what are we talking about? That is amazing. Like, yes, let's do that. And, you know, when they do that kind of thing, you know, they put the pie in the sky guest, you know, like maybe this type. We'll never get that person, but that type. But they reached out to her. And the only reason she took it, she did not know what Parks and Recreation was, but her daughter did. Her daughter, Sailor, and her daughter convinced her she's got to do the show. So when they say to me, well, we have your wife. Oh, who did we get? Christie Brinkley. Dude, when I was young, I had that red bathing suit poster in my room. And now she's playing my wife. It made no sense, and yet it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. And, you know, they gave Jerry, you know, my character at work was very put upon, I guess is a good term. You know, he was the punching bag. So Mike said, we got to give him a real life, or why hasn't he killed himself at this point? Like, we got to give him something.
Yeah.
So they gave Jerry a whole lot. They gave him an amazing family, a huge penis, you know, the big stuff.
Okay, so now you're sure that everything is okay, you know, down there?
You're perfectly healthy. That man has the largest penis I have ever seen. Actually, don't even know if he has mumps. Forgot to look. I was distracted by the largest penis I have ever seen.
And so they really took care of him where it counted. But dude, I was so excited. And then Christy showed up that first day, and she is, this is going to sound crazy. Maybe you'll know what I'm saying or not. She's sunshine. If that makes any sense.
She's luminescent. She brightens like, this is up. Human? You're like, we're of the same species?
Okay, exactly.
If you say
she
so.
Brightens up a room. She brightens it up. And she saw me the first day, and I'm thinking, oh, is she going to be like a little stand? Like, oh, you know, here's this gorgeous woman. And out of all the characters, she's got to be my wife. And she saw me, and she just screamed. We were in the studio lot, and she was in the parking area, and she just screamed, my husband! And she ran over to me and gave me the greatest hug. And I thought, oh my God, I love this. So it was awesome. And she is smart and funny and a great storyteller. I hear she has a book coming out, which she should. She has been through it. And you know, Rob Lowe, who was also, you know, he played Chris on the show. He is a great storyteller also. But even he, when Christy was telling stories, even Rob would just be sitting there, and we're all staring at her like, what the hell is she telling us? Because she has been through it. And so.
But you know, it also must be nice for Rob to, for once, be in a room with someone who's plausibly better looking than he is. just to not be the upper 1% that one day sighs.
Exactly. For a little bit. You know, Rob and I are, I think there's a year and a half difference in our ages. And one time some article came out, and it was our pictures next to each other, and it said, what's wrong with these pictures? And they were mocking me, obviously. Yeah, yeah. But I said to Rob, dude, you are what's wrong with this picture. I look like the hell I'm supposed to look like, okay? You, sir.
Let me give you my name, age, demographic, and family history. That comports.
And I'll show you. That's who I look like, yes. You, sir, have made whatever deal you've made with the devil. God bless you. But I am not the freak in this picture you are.
We'll be back with more of Jim O'Hare in a minute. We're back with Jim O'Hare. He's written a new book, Welcome to Pawnee, Stories of Friendship Waffles and Parks and Recreation. As an actor, how you look and come across, that is your actual business. But I was reading your Wikipedia page, and these were some reviews or quotes from earlier roles. The grotesquely ursine Jim O'Hare. Ursine means bear-like. Couldn't they have left it at bear-like?
Exactly.
And then, as Harvey Crudup, the unattractive husband of protagonist Tammy Tyler. Did they have to say that we know what you look like? Yeah, I don't think it's unattractive.
When I was doing theater in Chicago, every review, and I mean, it could be a glowing review. It could be like the greatest actor we've ever seen. It will begin with the overweight, the sloppy, the whatever. They couldn't help themselves. Every single review, no matter how flattering ultimately the review was, they had to mention my size, my look, or whatever.
Even if you knew that and were aware of that and had a sense of humor about that and knew that this was the kind of acting you would do where you embrace that role, did it hurt?
It does. I'm sorry. I don't care who you are. You learn to numb it out. And I certainly have, because it still happens. I have been a fat guy since my understanding is 4 years old. They used to call me Peanut when I was between one and, you know, a child and four, because I was so scrawny. My dad called me Peanut. Well, I don't know whether they went overboard and fed me, or I was like, I'm going to break off from that saying. And I have certainly accomplished that. And I have been overweight always since I was 4 years old. I have mirrors. I know what I look like. But I also, to be an actor, I think a character actor, you are in a better spot to continually work than the leading man, because there's going to be a window. And with the grayer I got, the more work I got, the more wrinkles and the cheeks and whatever happened, the more work I got. So it's a blessing and a curse. Ultimately, I think, you know, I look like an O'Hare and I'm proud of it.
Well,
I was also, you know, those reviews were from the 80s and 90s, and supposedly we have come a little bit past that. And I think we probably, even though women are more policed and punished for not looking like the ideal, the supposed ideal, I don't know that people would put that in the newspaper today, but yeah. I do think, but you tell me, has that subsided? Are they still, do you still see these offhanded kind of insulting references to looks when it comes to men or you as a man in particular?
I think you can still do it to men. I think you're right about women, though. They have to be more careful. But I haven't really thought about it till I'm thinking about it right now, because a lot of reviews, you know, in the last couple of years, I've done a bunch of different things. I think you might be right. I think there has been less of that, because I'm now thinking in my head, I think there is less. And I don't know if it's because have I earned more respect? I don't know. Maybe when I was starting out, they're like, who is this guy? We can, you know, shit all over him. Who cares? I don't know. But that's interesting. I've never thought about it. But when I think about it now, I think there is less of commenting on my physical appearance. Though I have to, and this really isn't about physical appearance, but I want to share with you. I did a play in Chicago called Stumpy's Gang.
Yeah.
And it really opened up everything for me. It's
I believe
reason.
That was where the grotesquely assigned Jim O'Hare
exactly.
comes from.
Exactly. And one of the reviews on that show, and this is my favorite review of all time, here's a quote that has stuck with me forever. Here was the quote in the review. Jim O'Hare, though he seems like a nice enough fellow, should be embarrassed to do what he's doing on stage in the privacy of his own home. Is that a review?
Like, why is that person in theater reviews?
No.
Don't you know how this works?
Yes, but man, we even used it in the ads. Like, we pulled quotes from that, because it was like, hey, you want to see some effed up show? Apparently, this is the show you got to see. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Very edgy. So I do want to connect it to the tone of Parks and Rec, which it's not a cruel show. And I know, and I've read in your book, but I've even heard I've heard Mike Schur talk about this. In fact, I had him on a sports show we did. I mean, he's a great baseball guy, and we talked.
Oh, wait,
this.
I didn't know Mike liked sports.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Wait, Aziz likes technology? I didn't mm-hmm. know that. Yeah. So he was saying that the first season, and you get this, they weren't exactly sure what the tone should be in terms of how much they were going to mock the characters, maybe subtly, and how much on the side of the characters they were going to be. And then it changed a bit, and we were all rooting for Leslie rather than thinking that she was in this either quixotic or pointless or kind of sad existence. I mean, it changed a little bit, but it was important to the show. So that's one observation. But then I wanted to connect it to, but you were the punching bag. Was there some way that they punched not so cruelly, but enough to get the comedy across?
I get so many people say to me, I love that show. I love the show, but they were so mean to you. And that made me mad. And all that. And I see where they're coming from. I'm a huge Family Guy fan. You know, I'm the Meg. You know, if you watch Family Guy, Meg is for no reason shit up. Yeah. For absolutely no reason, you know, they are terrible to make. And so Jerry was that guy. It's so weird because I see where people are coming from. And some of the other cast members, like Chris Pratt, one time he said to me, I forget what the bit was, but it was, you know, a slam on Jerry. And Chris was like, you know, Jimmy, do you think this one seems pretty rough? Are you okay with this? And it's like, dude, number one, I love that type of humor. I am a blue type of humor guy. I am a ball buster. I like my own balls being busted. That's who, you know, put me in a room with a bunch of people who are just slamming the hell out of each other. That makes me happy. That is my go-to. So I loved it. And I said, also, we're all making a lot of money. So it's all good. Like life is good.
What your character became and fleshing it out and having you married to Christie Brinkley was connected. It wouldn't have happened. The contrast comedically wouldn't be as much if you weren't the punching bag in the office.
Exactly. And as I always point out, when it counted, they were always there for Jerry. They truly were. He was their go-to. Ron Swanson, there's a talking head where he says every office has a schlemiel and a schlemazel. In our office, Jerry is the schlemiel and the schlemazel, you know, so he's all of it. But the point being, when it mattered, they always had Jerry's back. And there's the great episode where my retirement episode, which of course scared the shit out of me. I thought they were getting rid of me, but they didn't. But Leslie comes to Jerry's house and she sees he's got it all. He's literally got it all. And Jerry knew what the situation was, but he also knew what was important to him. And he loves, I think Jerry loves everyone he works with, loves them. But nothing is more important than 5 o'clock and going home to his family. And there's nothing wrong with that. But Mike will tell the story that it got to the point in the writer's room. So many people were coming up with so many Jerry slams. He's finally like, okay, we got to write other stuff too. This can't just be about slamming Jerry.
Because I think writers love that, and the culture
it's
has
fun.
It's moved a little bit away from that. And if you give writers an opportunity to go off, they will.
And you know, to get back to the point you made earlier about, you know, like with Leslie's character and stuff, the blessing and the curse that Parks had at the very beginning was, I mean, what a blessing. We're giving you 6 episodes. Wow, that doesn't happen. The curse is, we're giving you 6 episodes, because normally you do a pilot and you can figure out what works and what doesn't work.
Right. Episode 2 is usually very different.
Yeah. Way different. They figure this character wouldn't do this, or maybe this character's gone, or this character's added. Pilots are super important. We didn't have that. And unfortunately, when the pilot aired, a lot of people were looking at Leslie's character as too much like Michael Scott's, you know, from The Office. And some people were turned off by that. So once the regrouping started and they found out who Leslie really was, in my opinion, of course I'm biased, whatever, from season 2, episode 1, we never went back. We soared. I thought every season was better. And I think the reason our seasons stayed as strong as they stayed is that Mike Shore never left us. A lot of times when a guy, girl creates a big show, they get pulled to do other stuff because the networks are like, give me another hit. And that happened with Mike, but in his case, he created Brooklyn Nine-Nine with Dan Gore. But Dan Gore left us, and Mike stayed with us. So we never lost Mike's voice. And I believe that's why the show stayed as strong as it did for, you know, all 7 seasons.
Jim O'Hare he's Jerry, and he's the author of If You Like the Show, or even if you're somewhat curious about how big ensemble comedies work when they really work well, he's the author of Welcome to Pawnee. Jim, it was great talking to you.
Let me just quickly ask, did you see the cover?
I think so. I got the PDF of the cover.
How great is that cover? And I take no credit for it. I didn't do it. But it's genius. And for fans of the show, it's caricatures of the cast as well as all the recurring characters. There's Easter eggs for the people, you know, the young people who use that term. I learned recently what it meant. Anyway, so I'm a big fan of the cover. Yeah.
So you're saying if you were to judge a book by its cover, that's perfectly fine with you.
This is the book. This is the book to judge by its cover. Yes.
It's good inside, but you know, it kind of goes down from there. Yeah. It's like a show where the pilot episode is the best one.
Exactly.
Jim, great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You too, Mike. This was fun.
And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by the Quaint Mallards, Corey Wara, and senior producer Joel Patterson. Leo Baum's our intern, Michelle Pesca, CBSO of Peachfish Productions, Umperu G Peru, Du Peru, and thanks for listening.